I prepare a message, but I always try to be open to what the Lord's doing. And, it occurred to me, Jesus became human. He became one of us. He entered into that emotion so that when we enter into what he did for us, we experience that again. Well, our theme for 2025 is live like Jesus. And it comes out of a simple desire to follow Jesus. I have a ringing up here. Does the monitor need to be turned off or something? That's better. Nope, it's still there. It comes out of a simple desire to follow Jesus, to learn better what that means. And we are spending the entire year in the Gospel of Matthew. So 3 weeks ago began the season of Lent. Lent is a 40-day period of time leading up to Passover and to Resurrection Sunday. And it's a time of self-examination and of repentance. So during this time, we follow Jesus through the events leading up to his crucifixion and resurrection. It's a season that we normally refer to as Passion. You've heard me say this before. We think of Passion as a strong feeling or emotion, like Alan was demonstrating for us here. But the season of Passion, it really comes from the Latin root meaning suffering. And it's a time to allow ourselves to experience what Jesus experienced as he fully entered into our human experience. We want to fully enter into his passion, into his experience. I want to begin with Galatians 2:20. This may be a familiar scripture, but I want to read it from the Passion Translation, a translation which seeks to kind of expound a bit and help to identify that feeling. My old identity has been co-crucified with Messiah, Paul writes, and no longer lives. For the nails of his cross crucified me with him. And now, in essence, the essence of this new life is no longer mine, for the Anointed One lives his life through me. We live in union as one. And my new life is empowered by the faith of the Son of God, who loves me so much that he gave himself for me. He dispenses his life into mine. That's passion. Last week we talked about the fellowship of Christ's sufferings. We identified some of the contrasts and tensions that we feel as we identify with Jesus heading toward the cross. This week we're going to be discussing Jesus' arrest and his trial. You know, an artist once painted a scene of the crucifixion. I don't know if this is the one or not, but it's a scene of the crucifixion. But rather than depicting Jesus alone, as he's painting the crowd, he included his own figure among the crowd, painting himself as one of those who turned away. And he was reflecting in that our own propensity to shy away from standing with Jesus when it matters most. And as we look at today's passage, we are called to confront our own complacency. Standing with Jesus invites us into vulnerability and into courage, challenging us to live up to visibly live in our faith and reminding us that we are never truly alone. So we are going to be reading through these passages in Matthew 26 and 27. And as we move through these texts, I want to challenge you to imagine yourself in them as part of the crowd, as one of the disciples, maybe as a Jewish leader or as a Roman soldier. Put yourself in the story. What would you do? Would you defend Jesus? How would you define Jesus? By the way, these are also the points on your outline if you're following along on your insert or in your e-bulletin. Would you defend Jesus? How would you define Jesus? Or would you even decide for Jesus? What would you do anything different than what they did? Now, it makes a difference that here we are 2,000 years later and we have full knowledge of what happens next, right? So now apply it to today. How do you stand with Jesus in your story and in your context? How do you respond when Jesus' name is mentioned? How or when do you bring Jesus into the conversation? You know, it's easy to criticize these characters in the gospel narrative for how they acted toward Jesus, but when you look at them in context, you know, I doubt if we would have done anything different. But being here where we are, we can learn from them. And we can learn from them how to stand with Christ today. So let's begin with defending Jesus. Matthew 26, verse 47. While he was still speaking, Judas came, one of the 12, and with him a great crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now the betrayer had given them a sign, saying, "The one I will kiss is the man. Seize him." And he came up to Jesus at once and said, "Greetings, Rabbi." And he kissed him. And Jesus said to him, "Friend, do what you came to do." And then they came up and laid hands on Jesus and seized him. And behold, one of those who were with Jesus stretched out his hand, and he drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. And Jesus said to him, "Put your sword back into its place, for all who take up the sword will perish by the sword. Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? But now that the scriptures should be fulfilled, that it must be so." At that hour, Jesus said to the crowds, "Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to capture me? Day after day, I sat in the temple teaching, and you didn't seize me then. But all this has taken place that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled." And then all the disciples left him and fled. So imagine you're in the garden that night when Jesus is arrested. So Judas, we know Judas. He was one of the 12. And you know very well, so what he was giving was a customary greeting. You know, the kiss on a cheek, right? And as soon as he does this, the soldiers move in from out of the shadows. One of the other gospel writers tells us that it was Peter who whipped out the sword, swings for a guy's head, ends up cutting his ear off. Jesus, instead of taking advantage of the moment to break away and run, which is what Alan would teach us to do in self-defense, right? Cause a distraction and then run, right? He turns and rebukes Peter. Another gospel writer tells us that he healed the servant's ear. In all the chaos and confusion, the only calm presence in this story is Jesus. Jesus is not caught up in the chaos. This is exactly what the scriptures say should happen, Jesus says. Jesus is not leading a rebellion. Instead, he uses this as a teaching moment. Oh, and by the way, Jesus is not being captured. He's going willingly. I would like to think that if I were one of the disciples, that I too would defend Jesus. However, what we learn from this text when we really study it is something completely different. And here's your first fill in the blank. Jesus doesn't need us to defend him. He doesn't need us to defend him. Your fake kisses don't impress him. Your concealed weapons just get in the way. You know, all Jesus really wants is for you to stand with him. But like the disciples, what do? First of all, we try to control the situation. And if we can't control the situation, we run away. Or if we're really brave, like Peter, we follow stealthily at a distance. Let me pick up in verse 57. Then those who had seized Jesus led him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders had gathered. And Peter was following him at a distance, as far as the courtyard of the high priest. And going inside, he sat with the guards to see the end. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking false testimony against Jesus, that they might put him to death, but they found none. Though many false witnesses came forward, at last two came forward and said, "This man said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days.'" And the high priest stood up and said, "Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?" But Jesus remained silent. And the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." And Jesus said to him, "You have said it so. But I tell you, from now on you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his robes and said, "He has uttered blasphemy. What further witness do we need? You've now heard the blasphemy." So Peter is sitting on the edge in the shadows of this courtyard. Now, the courtyard of the high priest is kind of like the local courthouse. It's where you go when you need a legal matter settled. The Jews had a special status in the Roman Empire. They were allowed to practice their own religion, provided that they were, at least to a degree, self-governing. That means all of the local disputes needed to be handled here. Now, historically and traditionally, the Jews try to avoid any Roman interference in their own matters. The Old Testament has laws. Old Testament prescribes penalties for those who injure or those who steal, so they wanted to implement their own laws. And by the way, in those laws in Leviticus, the worst case scenario is that a person who injures or steals and can't pay the penalty, well, they become a slave to the one whom they owe the debt, and that only for up to 7 years. But the high priest, within this generation, however, began turning Jewish criminals over to Roman authorities to be executed. And that served as a more effective deterrent. But it also received a lot of pushback from some of the devout Jews who were opposed to this Roman thirst for violence. And so it was usually reserved for the worst of the worst. So here we have this impromptu courtroom, which was suddenly filled with people who were accusing Jesus. Now, the text says that there were a number of them. Most of them lacked credibility, according to the text. However, there was a couple who heard him say that he would destroy the temple. Now, John gives us a little bit more information on that. John 2, verses 19 and 20, Jesus answered them, speaking to the scribes and Pharisees, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." Then the Jews said, "It's taken 46 years to build this temple, and you will raise it up in 3 days?" But John notes, he was speaking about the temple of his body. If only there was somebody present in the high priest's courtyard who actually heard Jesus say that. That's right, he's hiding over in the shadows. A threat against the temple might be a plausible charge for turning Jesus over to the Romans, except that Jesus himself gives them an even better reason. When they asked him if he's the Son of God, what Jesus said, he was actually quoting from Daniel's vision, Daniel 7:13. He says, "I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like the Son of Man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him." So, you know that one of the basic tenets of the Jewish religion is monotheism, right? There's only one God, right? But in this vision, Daniel sees one expression of the one true God talking to another expression of the one true God. You get it? The Ancient of Days, God, is on the throne, and another, like the Son of Man, also God, is presenting himself to the Ancient of Days. It's one of those mystery doctrines in ancient Judaism that they called the two powers in heaven. It was much debated. It's a picture of God coming to rule on earth. And Jesus says, before the high priest, quotes this passage and says, "This is being fulfilled now." And that infuriated the Pharisees and gave them a plausible threat on which to execute him, because he threatened their claim of divine rulership. Now the problem is, they're going to be turning him over to the Romans, and the Romans are not going to understand a complex argument based on Jewish apocalyptic literature. Who's going to explain it to them? Oh, let me see. There's a guy sitting over in the shadows who saw Jesus transfigured just shortly before this. What if he were to share his story? But Jesus doesn't need us to defend him. But Jesus does need people who will speak for him. And that's the next fill in the blank. Jesus doesn't need you to defend him, but Jesus wants you to testify about him. Let me pick up in verse 69. "Now Peter was sitting outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came up to him and said, 'You also were with Jesus the Galilean.' But he denied it before them all, saying, 'I don't know what you mean.' And when he went out to the entrance, another servant girl saw him
And she said to the bystanders, "This man was with Jesus of Nazareth." And again, he denied it with an oath, "I do not know the man." And after a little while, bystanders came up and said to Peter, "Certainly, you too are one of them. Your accent betrays you." And then he began to invoke a curse on himself, expletives, and to swear, "I do not know the man." And immediately the rooster crowed. And Peter remembered the saying of Jesus, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." And he went out and wept bitterly. Have you ever been there? God gives you an amazing opportunity to bear witness for him, and you blow it. I have. I've missed lots of opportunities. And sometimes I only realize it afterward. And sometimes, you know, I know it's a great opportunity. I just, you know, I freeze. God knows why. I don't always know why I do the things I do. All Peter had to do was tell what he had seen and heard. All that was needed was for him to tell his story. If he just told the truth about Jesus, his testimony could counter the false witnesses that were being brought against Jesus. But God knew what he was doing. God had a plan for Jesus to go to the cross. And he had a purpose for Peter to find out that he wasn't as brave as he thought he was. What about you? What opportunities has God given you to tell about Jesus? You know, everyone needs to know who Jesus is. And that's our next point. Defining Jesus. Now we're in Matthew chapter 27. When morning came, all the chief priests and the elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. And they bound him and led him away and delivered him over to Pilate, the governor. So now Caiaphas, the high priest, is sending Jesus to Pilate, the Roman governor. Caiaphas can condemn a prisoner as guilty, but only Pilate can sentence a person to death. But Pilate is a Roman governor. He doesn't know Jesus. Someone has to define Jesus, who, by the way, the accusation, the official accusation, is that he says he is the Son of God. Now, Pilate, who's receiving the prisoner, he has a completely different concept of God. He's not thinking God, one true God. He's thinking gods, like the Roman pantheon. You know, Caesar is said to be a son of the gods. So when they're handing Jesus over to him, saying that the charge is that he says he's the Son of God, Pilate's thinking, that's what they say about Caesar. And it's not just Pilate. We each need to define for ourselves, what do we think about Jesus? Who is Jesus? And if it's true that Jesus is God, then what are the implications for my life? As we follow the text, I'm going to break down that question into two more practical questions that are going to help you define not only who Jesus is, but what that means for you. So here's your next fill in the blank. What is Jesus worth to you? What is Jesus worth to you? Let me pick up in verse 3. Then when Judas, his betrayer, saw that Jesus was condemned, he changed his mind and he brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, "I've sinned by betraying an innocent blood." And they said, "What's that to us? See to it yourself." And throwing down the pieces of silver into the temple, he departed, and he went and hanged himself. But the chief priests, taking the pieces of silver, said, "It's not lawful to put them into the treasury because it's blood money." So they took counsel and bought with them the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. Therefore, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then it was fulfilled what had been spoken by the prophet Jeremiah, saying, "And they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of him on whom a price had been set by some of the sons of Israel, and they gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord directed me." Yes, Jeremiah actually bought a field called the potter's field with 30 pieces of silver. How's that for a prophetic act? So apparently Judas, at least at first, thought Jesus was worth 30 pieces of silver. You know what 30 pieces of silver is in the Bible? In the Old Testament? It's the value of a slave. Exodus 21:32. "If the ox gores a slave, male or female, the owner shall give their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned." It's the value of a slave. Now Judas realizes his betrayal, and he no longer wants the money. But he can't give it back because now it's blood money. The coins are associated with death, and by the way, you can't put a price on death. But you can use those same coins to buy a burial plot for people who have no family ties, no place to be buried. You know, they're still worth something. We just don't know what they're worth. By the way, it's also a potter's field. You know, potters don't need fields to grow pots, right? What would a potter use a field for? Well, it's where they put all the wasted shards of broken pottery. In fact, there's a historical site that's associated with this passage that was discovered in the medieval times. It actually contains a giant cave, like 20 feet wide, 70 feet deep, and it's strewn with broken pottery and with bones. The price paid for Jesus was used as a resting place for discarded pots and discarded people. Everyone is worth something to God, even a slave, even foreigners, even Judas, yes, even you. You are worth the life of God's Son. And if you're worth so much to God, then what is Jesus worth to you? Is he worth your time? Is he worth your allegiance? Is he worth your obedience? Is he worthy of your praise? Who you think Jesus is begins with how much you value what Jesus has done for you and what he continues to do for you. Let me ask you another question. This is the next fill in the blank. What is Jesus' role in your life? How much is Jesus worth to you, and what is Jesus' role in your life? Picking up in verse 11, "Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, 'Are you the king of the Jews?' And Jesus said, You said it. But when he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer. Then Pilate said to him, "Do you hear how many things they are testifying against you?" But he gave him no answer, not even to a single charge, so that the governor was greatly amazed. So notice that Pilate does not ask Jesus if he said he is the Son of God, or the Son of the gods, as Pilate would have understood it. But he goes right for the interpretive question. Are you a king? After all, that's what Son of the gods would have meant to Pilate. In his thinking, divine equals ruler, and ruler equals authority. And if you are a ruler, well, then you must have a domain. Jesus is a Jew, so he must be the king of the Jews. And now Pilate is being really provocative, because for some Jews, the very idea of having a king would have been repulsive. And for others, it would have been a political trap. "Those are your words," Jesus says, as he quietly slips the noose. But Pilate's question is relevant. You know, if you are an important person, surely you have a purpose. You have a reason for being here. You have a role to play in the grand scheme of things. You know, important people do important things. Otherwise, they are not really all that important. So what makes you important, Jesus? That's what Pilate is asking. What makes you important, Jesus? Let me ask you, why is Jesus important to you? Colossians 1:16-17 says this, "For by him," talking about Jesus, "for by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together." What makes you so important, Jesus? What a ridiculous question. You know, if Jesus is at the center of the universe, holding all things together, what is his place in your life? Who's at the center of your universe? Who holds you together? And if all that's true, then what is our appropriate response? Now we move into the third part, deciding for Jesus. I'm going to pick up in verse 15. "Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to release for the crowd any one prisoner whom they wanted. And they had then a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. So when they had gathered, Pilate said to them, 'Whom do you want me to release for you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ?' For he knew that it was out of envy that they had delivered him up. Besides, while he was still sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him, 'Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for I have suffered much because of him today in a dream.' Now the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to destroy Jesus. The governor again said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release for you?" And they said, "Barabbas." Pilate said to them, "What shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?" And they said, "Let him be crucified." And he said, "What? What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Let him be crucified." So this is one of those scenes that must have been so surreal, like something out of a movie. Pilate is looking for a way out because he's not keen on crucifying someone who seems to be more of a personal threat to the religious leaders than an actual criminal. And he gives them a choice between Jesus and an actual known criminal. And you would think the choice would be obvious. But in that moment, something else happens. The people start shouting for Barabbas. And other people just go with it. It's like an echo chamber. Nobody's thinking, everybody's shouting. It's mob rule. And the people are whipped into a frenzy. It doesn't make sense, but everybody's doing it. You know, everybody's, "Barabbas, Barabbas." You know, it's fun to say, "Barabbas." Here's the next fill in the blank. Whose voice will you listen to? Picking up in verse 24. When Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took water, he washed his hands before the crowd, saying, "I am innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves." And the people answered, "His blood be on us and on our children." And then he released for them Barabbas, having scourged Jesus, delivered him to be crucified. So what's happening here? This is clearly not what Pilate intended to happen. His wife warned him that she had a bad feeling about it. The text says that the chief priests and the elders were somehow behind it. Maybe they started the chant. Maybe they had paid protesters, you know? It's an old trick. It's been done for a long time. But have you ever noticed that most people just tend to go with whatever other people are saying? Does anybody ever stop and ask, "Hey, by the way, what's your source of information?" Or even if it is true, is that the whole story? How is it that the same people who were cheering for Jesus riding into Jerusalem just a week before are now shouting for his execution? Doesn't sound like people are critically evaluating the news. Sounds like people who will dance to whatever tune happens to be playing. Have you ever stopped and asked yourself, "Whose voice am I listening to?" I'm not just talking about who's speaking. I'm talking about what is the voice behind the one that's speaking. By the way, Pilate is not the good guy here. However, he seems to be the most level-headed. If only he would have listened to his wife. The chief priests are the ones who are the driving force behind the mob, who, by the way, is demanding the very thing that you would think the chief priests would be opposed to: release an insurrectionist.
What are they thinking? When what people are saying makes no sense, when their words don't line up with their actions, you have to know there are other voices behind the voices that are speaking. And whose voice are you listening to? Just a quick tip, don't go with the loudest one. Next, fill in the blank. Whose lead will you follow? Whose voice are you listening to, and whose lead will you follow? Verse 27. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters, and they gathered the whole battalion before him. And they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. And twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on his head. And they put a reed in his right hand. You know, a reed is just kind of... And kneeling before him, they mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they spit on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him and stripped him of the robe and put his own clothes on him, they led him away to crucify him. Have you ever noticed that when you make a wrong choice, next thing you know, you don't have a choice anymore? Or at least it doesn't feel like you do. Choices have consequences, and they start you down a path, and you don't always know where that path is going to take you. These Roman soldiers, they're charged with carrying out an execution. But what's happening here is not execution. This is nothing but a humiliation ritual. Maybe it was the crowd. Maybe someone put them up to it. Or maybe it's just Roman soldiers doing what Roman soldiers do, you know, because you can. And maybe it's all of the above plus a demonic manifestation of evil. I don't know if these soldiers actually knew what was driving them. You know, the only thing they were probably thinking in the moment is that nobody could stop them. Have you ever thought about what drives you? Whose lead are you following? Are you just going with the mocking crowd? Or are you maybe on a little power trip yourself? It's easy to understand and identify with the people in the story when you consider that they only knew a little bit of what you know. You know how this story ends. But even though we know about Jesus' death and resurrection, we still find ourselves with the same temptations and the same choices, and I would even add, we still find ourselves making the same mistakes. Will you stand with Jesus? And will you move with Jesus toward the cross? Here's some questions for reflection this week. Number one, I want you to just think for a moment and realize how privileged you are to know Jesus. You know the rest of the story. Do you know there are people in this world who have never heard the gospel? They have never heard this story, not even once. And then there are people who have heard the gospel, but they don't know it's real. They think it's just a story.
They don't know it's real. And then there are those people that know the gospel, they know it's real, but they think it's not for them. Like, I've already messed up too much. Like, I'm already too bad. God's never going to accept me. You know what? They need to hear your story. You could tell them the truth about Jesus. Who are the people in your life, and what part of your story do they need to hear? Question number two, who is Jesus to you? What is his value to you? What role does he have in your life? And then just pulling all of that together, is what you believe about Jesus reflected in the way you live your life? Maybe it would help with the third question to get a little bit more specific. Think about a recent choice that you made. What voices influenced that choice? What aspirations or desires were behind that choice? Like, what was driving you? And how are all of the choices in your life influenced by that one choice to follow Jesus? Let's stand and worship as we think about these things.